Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan. As more and more of our books, records, and media become digital, librarians and archivists have struggled with the best way to preserve these items for the future. A book can survive for centuries, but hard drives, not so much. Also, malware, such as computer viruses, can destroy data, holding it for ransom or steal it, as we saw in the recent hack of the Democratic National Committee. While malware can put digital archives at risk, they are also a part of our history and may be worth preserving in their own right. But that can be tricky. Joining us now by phone is graduate researcher in the Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Department at New York University, Jonathan Farbowitz. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Before we dive into questions of preservation, can we define malware for us? Tell us a bit about types of software we're talking about here.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So at the base level, it's just a word for malicious software. What gets defined as malicious is a little bit a gray area sometimes. But essentially what we're talking about are computer viruses, computer worms. There are also other types of, those are the most familiar probably to most people. There are other types of malware called ransomware or spyware. And there are also things called backdoors or Trojan horses, which might allow someone to take access, to access a computer without the user's knowledge or consent.
A general term would be hacking your computer in some way, shape, or form, right?
Yeah, well, it's, we should draw a slight distinction between hacking and malware. So sometimes hacking doesn't involve any software at all. Someone breaks into a computer system because they know how it works, or they get a password through maybe tricking someone. That's called social engineering, you know, just like tricking someone over the phone. So hacking, you know, malware would kind of fall under hacking as kind of a larger practice. But malware is, it's always a software or a script, some piece of code that is doing something.
You've argued that malware should be preserved for future study. When did you start first thinking about this as a problem?
Well, I guess I've always kind of been interested in kind of hacking and hacker culture ever since my undergrad. And what happened was, in my graduate program, we talk a lot about processing born digital items like hard drives and disks, because libraries are getting a lot of those, and archives, libraries and archives and museums are getting a lot of those in their collections. And people always talk about virus scanning. And at a conference, I asked one of the presenters, you know, well, what happens if you find a virus? Because I was, you know, I was genuinely curious. And she said, oh, we just remove it. She actually wasn't correct about her institution's policy, but it caught the attention of me, and it caught the attention of my thesis advisor, Howard Besser, and he got a little incensed and stood up and said, you know, well, what if someone wants to study this infection or something like that? And that really piqued my interest. I thought, you know, maybe, yeah, what information can we get from an infection? And I just kind of went from there, and I've been getting very very like encouraging feedback. So I just kept looking and looking, and now the field I think just keeps growing, because everywhere I look, people are talking about malware.
Well, can you give me an example of how malware from our history would possibly have some cultural significance?
Yeah,
why a historian would be interested in it?
Yeah. Well, recently I saw a clip on the Conan O'Brien show where George R. R. Martin, the guy who writes the Game of Thrones books, says that he uses an older computer and a word processor called WordStar. This is very early, I think, the first word processor. And part of the reason is because he says it won't get infected with viruses and he won't lose his work. So you kind of wonder, like, how many authors have lost their work because of malware and maybe changed their manuscript somehow, or it's changed their process. Another example that I give in the article is a political activist. So, you know, in the same way that historians look at, the wiretapping of Martin Luther King's phone, they'll want to see in the future if an activist had spyware installed on his or her computer.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, and we're talking about the challenges of securing safely malware. And if you have a question or comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513. But if malware is a virus and can cause problems, aren't we afraid a little bit, Jonathan, that this could again get in the wrong hands trying to save it?
Yeah, I know people have expressed that concern, and I don't want to be necessarily cavalier about saving it, especially malware that makes network connections. So, conceivably someone could be demonstrating a piece of malware at an archive, and that if that archive's computers were connected to the internet, it could launch attacks from the archive, which of course we don't want that. But not all malware is created equal. So you have a lot of historical malware like MS-DOS viruses. I don't know if you remember MS-DOS.
I do, actually.
But a lot of those viruses don't make network connections, and they are specifically designed for DOS. So if I have that file on, Mac OS X, for example, it just looks like a bunch of code that the computer doesn't know how to understand. So, some viruses, especially the older ones, they're only going to run on obsolete computers. So they're not going to pose much of a threat. And in the way archives tend to store things, which is on something called a disk image, which is a file that's a copy of a hard drive or a disk, nothing is actually being executed on the disk image. So it's kind of like a way to like seal things in a little package. So from there, it's, we call them computer viruses, but they're not biological things. If they're contained, for example, within a disk image, they can't go anywhere. They can't migrate.
It seems like you're talking about the best protection for folks is if they use older equipment. So what's
right.
that? I mean, what's that going to do for us as we go forward?
Well, right now, we're in a very it's a tricky time because we have a lot of different like state actors and corporations making a lot of this stuff. But eventually, whatever exploit was created, people aren't going to use that system anymore. So, like my recommendation for archives would be start with the older malware, start with the stuff that's obsolete, and then move on later as you gain more confidence to the newer stuff. And, even the stuff that seems dangerous today, in 10 years, it might not be very threatening because nobody's using that system anymore, mm-hmm. except maybe George R.R. Martin.
Are there any places now that are archiving malware for study?
Not that I know of. I do point out several projects in the article that I wrote, including the Internet Archive's Malware Museum. And also, there have been a few art exhibits related to malware. So there was an exhibit called Project Cybervirus in San Francisco, and there was one called I Love You, based on the I Love You virus in Frankfurt, Germany, and that toured around the world. But these there isn't necessarily a major institution like connected with a university that's really committed to making a comprehensive collection, and also not just collecting the code, but also when you collect stuff, let's say related to a movie, you're not just going to collect the film reels, you're going to collect the scripts. You're going to collect the publicity photos and all the contextual stuff that tells you about how the movie was made and how the movie was promoted. So in the same way, I'm arguing that an institution ought to collect all that contextual material. So not just the code, but also things people posted on the internet related to the virus, or websites where people talk about the effects, or news articles, or even interviews with people who wrote it, if we can get a hold of them, or people who fought it.
Is this controversial in the world of archivists and librarians?
I think sometimes people, like the concerns you expressed about safety,
right.
People are concerned about safety and especially liability. If you're going to demonstrate this stuff on a computer, you have to make sure that, you know, if the researcher brings their computer to the archive, their computer wouldn't get damaged, or, you know, we're not demonstrating it on a computer connected to the internet. So I think safety is the major concern. That's what I've heard mostly from archivists. The other concern is kind of, which I've been trying to address is what's the value of saving it.
Mm-hmm. And if in your article, you say 82,000 new malware threats are created each day,
Yeah, that's right. And, that was from, I believe, 2013, and there are more now.
So how do you decide which ones to save? The ones that cause the most damage? The ones that are the most innovative?
Exactly, yeah. That's something that, like, we as a community have to, a community of archivists have to discuss. Some archives might have a collecting policy where they collect, you know, let's say malware that's related to social justice movements or protest movements. Maybe another archive collects malware that where the code is very innovative. So that's what I would like to see. I would like to see specialized collecting like that. I think we can really benefit from that. Luckily, while there are lots of threats, a lot of them are redundant. So it's just people recycling the same code over and over again. So we're not necessarily, you know, talking about things that are completely unique.
Mm-hmm. What are the technical challenges then in making sure that if we're going to save some of these, they don't get out and cause big problems for anyone?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, isolated computer networks are one way. Non-network connected computers, non-network connected storage. So hard drives, where it's very difficult for people to get access to them. Also, I think actually multiple copies, a lot of backup copies. So in digital archiving, we have a principle called locks. Lots of copies keep stuff safe. And so if anything should go wrong with, you know, malware that's being stored, you have, you know, a clean copy. Like if files got deleted in your digital storage, you have a copy somewhere else that you can bring to fix things. So that's another strategy as well.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where this all goes. Jonathan,
yeah.
Thank you for being with
sure.
us. Jonathan Farbowitz is a graduate student at Moving Image Archiving and Preservation at New York University. Thank you again. And coming up on Tech Tuesday, how to take advantage of smart home technology even if you are renting your home. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan. The age of the Internet of Things is upon us. Nearly every gadget or home appliance you can imagine has a smart version that is connected to the cloud and at your fingertips. This can be great for tech-savvy homeowners, but renters may be left out. Leases typically have language that prohibits the installation of certain everyday appliances, limiting a renter's smart home options. However, there are a slew of smaller-scale products available to renters. Joining us by phone to talk about the best products for renters is Associate Reviewer for Ars Technica, Valentina Palladino. Thanks for being here, Valentina.
Thanks for having me.
We hear a lot about smart home technologies, but do you have a sense of how many consumers are actually using some of these products?
It's kind of hard to say just because a lot of these products are so new and, you know, even the companies making them are trying to figure out what are the best uses for these products. How do customers really want to use them, and how do they implement them in their homes? So it's kind of hard to say exactly how many users are using them, but there are certain products that have become more prevalent on your store shelves. So there are some products that are definitely more established than others.
And what would those be?
A lot of them are small products, such as smart light bulbs and smart lighting kits, smart home camera monitors, so cameras that monitor your home when you're away, and you can look at it from your smartphone. Those are the two really big ones, and also smart home thermostats, although with renters, you know, some of those things are not applicable.
Right. Do these smart home technologies, do they all have to come from the same company in order to be compatible with each other?
No, they don't. So there are a lot of protocols out there. Two of the biggest ones are Zigbee and Z-Wave, and they're kind of across the board. They make products that will work on their protocols. They run on radio waves. But there are also larger companies such as Apple and Amazon that have their own protocols that they kind of license other products that are compatible with their system.
So what products do you think renters would use and benefit from most?
Well, it goes back to the ones that are more established. The smart home security cameras and the light bulbs are certainly the easiest to implement, simply because they're smaller products, but also they're fairly inexpensive when you compare it to the rest of the smart home category of products. So with light bulbs, you know, you can buy singular smart light bulbs that connect to Wi-Fi and have smartphone apps that you can control them from.
And so you're talking about turning off and on these lights, right?
Yes. Yes, you can turn them off and on. You can set them on schedules. If it uses a smartphone app on your phone, you can also, with some of them, use the GPS on your phone so it can kind of sense when you're on your way home. So when you get close enough, it'll turn on your lights. So, yes, that's what we mean by smart home lighting.
Well, what restrictions then should renters look out for and maybe look in their lease to see what they can and can't do, I suppose?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the biggest tip is to read your lease and read your lease thoroughly. See what you can and cannot do in terms of the wiring in your apartment. That's why I mentioned with smart home thermostats, most renters can't use those just because you don't really have access to the wiring behind your thermostat, and you don't really want to touch that. Otherwise, you might get hit with some sort of fee for messing up something in your apartment. You also want to look at the lock agreements. Most leases won't let you change the locks without contacting management. So a lot of smart locks you really won't be able to use. And one other very specific case, but in my lease for my apartment, I'm not allowed to install any in-window AC units because I already have some that are built into the walls of my apartment.
What are they called? In-window?
The in-window AC units, like the box.
Oh, AC. Gotcha.
Yes. Yes, so I'm not allowed to put those into my apartment windows because they're already too spread throughout my apartment. So there are a few smart home like window AC units, but I wouldn't be able to use those because my lease prohibits that.
Smart lighting is something that you mentioned. One of the products that is probably easiest for renters to use. What are some of the possibilities out there? How can you use this smart lighting?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you have a bunch of light bulbs, or even if you have one specific light bulb or lamp that you want to make smart, you can, if you get certain light bulbs such as a Philips Hue, you can kind of change the lighting, the colors of the light in your home. And Philips, I know specifically, is very into the idea that the colors of light and the intensity of light can help your concentration, can help you fall asleep better. So if you're having trouble maybe falling asleep, you might want to try a dimmable smart light bulb where you can change the color, kind of set the mood so that you can fall asleep a little bit better. And at the same time, if you wanted to do something the opposite way, if you wanted to concentrate more, if you're working at home, you might want to change the color to a, you know, bright white or bluish light that could help you concentrate a little bit more on your work.
Hmm. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Gable Hogan, and we're talking about the best smart home gadgets for renters. Our guest is Associate Reviewer for Ars Technica, Valentina Palladino. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, Valentina, you said you couldn't use a smart lock where you are. What is good for renters to take advantage of? Are there smart locks that will work?
Yes. So, yes, I'm not allowed to change the locks of my apartment, and most renters aren't. But there are a few locks out there that would either replace just the deadbolt or go over the deadbolt of your lock, so you wouldn't actually be having to take out any hardware. One of those I know off the top of my head is a lock called Lockatron, and they're currently shipping to the first purchasers now. I wasn't able to try that one out, but I did get a sample of the August Smart Lock, which it does replace your deadbolt, so you would have to take out some hardware for that, but at least it's not the full lock of your door that would completely change, you wouldn't be changing keys or anything. And with those types of smart locks, you'd be able to see, if somebody was trying to get into your door unexpectedly, you could unlock your door for somebody who you know was coming, like a friend or a family member, somebody who doesn't have a key. So it is convenient if you can figure out, what's written in your lease about the locks and which ones you actually want to install in your home.
What about smart security systems? What products do you recommend in that space, which I think would be important for renters?
Sure, yeah. I mean, smart home security cameras are probably the easiest ones to implement because they're basically just one-off products that you plug into a wall. You give them power through an AC adapter or an AC outlet, and they hook up to your Wi-Fi or they hook up to an Ethernet port in your router. And with that, you can control them via a smartphone app. So essentially, if you have a camera set up in the corner of your living room or your hallway that leads out your front door, you can see when you're not around what's happening. And if there is movement, many of them have motion detectors or even sound detectors, that if there's something happening in your home when you're away, you'll get an alert on your smartphone and you can see what happened.
But no matter where you are, you can use that app to turn the camera off and on?
Some of them you can, yes. Most of the time when you plug them in, they are on, even if they're not actively watching your home in kind of an alarmed state. Many of them have different states. When you're home, it's not going to let you know if something happened because you're home. The assumption is that you know what's happening in your home when you're actually there. But when you're away, it goes into a more armed state where it will alert you. And some of them actually know, they're smart enough to know when you've left after a certain amount of time, they can go into that alarmed state without you doing anything.
And I think a few people I know use these really to watch their pets more than anything else.
Yes, it's funny, but I mean, it's a nice way to stay connected with pets. And also, if you have children who come home when you're at work and you're not there to greet them, and some of them do have two-way audio, so you could talk to your pets, you could talk to your children. We don't want to scare them if you just, if they hear your voice coming through the camera.
Well, how quickly do some of these technologies become out of date? Because new things are coming out every day.
Sure. I mean, that's kind of hard to say just because the Internet of Things movement is so new, especially in the smart home world. I wouldn't necessarily be worried about certain products becoming out of date. Like, let's say if you were to buy a smart home security camera and you're worried the next year that there might be a newer version. There might be, but they tend to have smaller improvements, maybe slightly better video quality. But also, there's just so many companies getting into this space that there's going to be many, many new products all the time. So if you wanted to invest in something, especially like a smaller product, you could go for it. And then I wouldn't be too worried about it becoming super out of date very quickly. But I would be wary about so many other products coming out that maybe one suits your needs better.
But what about then that technology of tying it to the cell phone? Because cell phones are changing. So how many of these won't be compatible anymore with a cell phone or an app?
That all depends on the companies making them and how much they choose to update their software and their apps. Most of them stay on top of it fairly frequently, and a lot of companies can do a lot with software updates only. For example, Amazon has their Echo speaker, which also has the Alexa voice assistant in it. And with that, Amazon has been adding a lot of features to Alexa, but also other companies have been pushing out software updates to their products, such as smart lighting systems, smart home security cameras that make them compatible with Alexa. So I wouldn't be too worried about the software or anything like with your smartphone becoming out of date. If anything, it might work in your favor that if you keep that app with you and you keep using this product that you've bought for your home, you might even get to have more features in the future just with software updates.
Hmm. Let's also talk about smoke detectors. I think that sounds like a huge safety option for homeowners. Renters.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, that is one thing that you can take advantage of. Nest has their smart home thermostat, which I would stay away from just because it involves rewiring certain things in your home. But they do have the Nest Protect smoke detector and carbon monoxide detector. And that is also just controlled via an app. But with that type of thing, it's more preventative. I mean, you're not going to be going onto that smartphone app all the time. It's mainly just if you were to get, you know, a notification that carbon monoxide was detected or smoke was detected when you're not away, you'd be able to get that alert on your smartphone, which is really great because if there's some sort of issue at your home, especially with smoke, you'd be able to know about it even when you're not there.
Or carbon monoxide you can't smell, so you could even be there and not know about it.
Exactly.
In your opinion, then, what do you think are some of the biggest benefits of updating a rental with smart home products? And then what products would you recommend to folks as being the most viable?
Sure. I mean, some of the biggest benefits are just security when you're not around. Like we said, with the smart home security cameras and the thermostats and the carbon monoxide and smoke detectors, you know, if you are somebody who commutes a lot and you work a lot and you're not home all the time, you can use these products to your advantage to kind of keep track of what's going on in your home, see what's happening when you're away with your pets and all that kind of stuff. But also when you are there, there are certain things that can work more efficiently for you, such as your lights. If you have something like a smart vacuum, you know, like things like Roombas, you may not have to vacuum as much because you're using that around your apartment to clean for you, or even clean when you're not there if you set it on a schedule. So it just makes your life in your apartment a little bit easier and also a little bit more protected if you're someone who's away from your apartment a lot.
What then products would you suggest, especially for safety features?
Sure. I mean, I would go with definitely smart security cameras. I'm not sure if you want me to say specific products or just categories.
Either or.
I'm trying to think. Well, I mean, for lighting, I would definitely suggest Philips lighting systems. Hue are the ones that have the color-changing effects. But the thing I will say about that is that a lot of smart light bulbs, including the Philips ones, can be a little expensive in terms of each bulb, maybe around $40 or $50. However, Philips did recently come out with something called a Hue Lux bulb, which is just white lights that you can still control via your smartphone. And those bulbs are only about $20 each. So that's a nice way to jump into the smart home category. In terms of security, the smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors that are smart are really great. There's also something called a Roost Smart Battery, and that goes into your smoke detector. And that can, you don't have to get a smart device itself. You just get the smart battery. And that battery connects to an app on your smartphone, again, using Wi-Fi. And you'll be able to see if there was smoke detected in your home when you're not away. You'll get an alert with that. And also, yes, I would definitely suggest a smart home security camera, mainly because they're just one-off products. You can buy it, and then you can use the free tiers. Most of them have services that save your videos and photos, so you can look back on them just in case something were to happen and you need to look at the footage again. But a lot of them now have really good free tiers. Hopefully, you would never have to use that. But if something were to happen in your home, then you can go back and look at that footage. And there are a bunch of really great smart home security cameras. One that off the top of my head is called the Canary Cam. And all of them are around $150 to $200. So they're fairly inexpensive when you compare it to things like smart refrigerators or smart washer dryer systems that are thousands of dollars.
When you mentioned the smart battery Roost, does that battery go into any product?
No, it's specifically made for smoke detectors. And I believe it's about $30. And it's pretty useful just because if you're not away, that's what it's used for. If you're not away, it will let you know if there's activity in your home in terms of smoke. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to buy a completely new smoke detector or carbon monoxide detector to use it. You just insert it into your old one and it'll work via Wi-Fi.
Very cool. Well, Valentina, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Valentina Palladino is an associate reviewer for Ars Technica. And coming up on Tech Tuesday, we go from smart homes to smart tattoos. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan. Just about everything in our lives is becoming high tech, from smartphones to smart watches to smart homes and smart cars. Next on the horizon, smart tattoos. Researchers from Microsoft and MIT have released details about temporary tattoos that can be used to control devices with the touch of a fingertip. Joining us now to discuss that and other tech news is contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holly. Hi, Russell. Hey, Russell. Nice to see you. Hear you. This project is called Duo Skin, this tattoo thing. What's that about?
This is kind of fascinating. It's one of several projects that have, you know, kind of approached this, you know, how do we interact with phones or tablets or something like that in environments where we don't necessarily want to reach out and touch the actual screen? So there have been a couple of ideas for approaching this, and Microsoft is saying Duo Skin, where it relies on basically a gold metal leaf that is, you know, like a skin-friendly kind of robust design that they can lay on the skin in a couple of different, you know, really intricate patterns. The important part there is that it kind of lay on your skin in this kind of crosshatch pattern, making it close enough to your skin that it feels comfortable, but also making it so that you can run your finger across the surface and have it act as though it's a touching.
You know what? We are having a hard time, Russell, hearing you. We're going to try to call you back. So would you hold on and just hang up for a minute, and we're going to give you a call back.
Sure.
Great. Thank you. As we try to call back Russell, we'll again say that he is a contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, and we're talking about different tech items today. And the one tech item we're talking about is something called Duo Skin. It's a tattoo, and the tattoo apparently can be used to hook up to smartphones and other things like that. It's designed to actually help you if you're moving to do things easier because you have a tattoo on your arm. Are you there yet, Russell? He's not. Okay, so what we're going to talk about with Russell then besides that is AloClip Studio Case. It's a specific iPhone. And the other things we're going to talk about with Russell today, smart tattoos and... here he is. Okay, Russell, can we continue what we were talking about, Duo Skin, again, and we'll try to get a better connection now?
Sure.
Okay. Now you do sound better. Duo Skin, what is it?
Yeah, so the core behind Duo Skin is creating an interface where you don't necessarily have to reach out and touch the screen, and this happens by taking this kind of gold metal leaf material and laying it in a crosshatch pattern on your skin. That connects to a communicator, you know, Bluetooth or something like that, for wireless communication to a phone, basically making it so that you can touch, you know, areas of your skin and have it interact as though you were reaching out and touching a phone or a tablet.
You know, that does sound kind of creepy. Can I just say that?
It is definitely, it's a weird thing to think about, you know, to have this kind of spot on your skin that you would touch that allows you to interact with a phone. This is Microsoft is taking this a little bit further from what Google has been shown off for 2 years now that they call Project Jacquard, which is weaving this same kind of technology into clothing so that you would have like a spot on a jacket that you would reach out and touch and it would work as though you were interacting with your phone. Like you could, you know, swipe left and right to change tracks on your music without actually having to reach into your pocket and grab your phone, which is a weird thing to say out loud. You know, the idea that reaching into your pocket is too much work is kind of a silly thing. But the core of this kind of immediate kind of gesture control for things like adjusting the volume on something when you're in the middle of a phone call, it's really just kind of this push towards convenience where it kind of interacts with all of the things that you're touching. And the only real advantage that Microsoft Design has here with their work with MIT is that the use of this kind of gold leaf thing makes it so that you can have some really impressive kind of visual designs. So it just looks really kind of bizarre and fantastic on your skin.
Well, does it wash off on your skin? Or if you have it on a jacket or piece of clothing, if you put it in the washer, does it come off?
So the Project Jacquard stuff, they've actually worked with Levi to make it so that it is machine washable. This material here will work fine if you accidentally get some water on it or something like that, but is designed to kind of peel off at the end of the day when you're not using it.
So do they come in packets and then you just put a new one on every day? How does that actually work?
They haven't really gone that far yet where they've released it as kind of a consumer thing. This is definitely still a project, but the idea is something that they're kind of putting out there for people to think about. And it's weird to think about, you know, touching this design on my arm to answer a phone call or something like that. But, you know, in a couple of years, it may be the new normal.
Oh, I was going to say, do you see that as actually catching on or a fad for the people who really like gadgets, that this would be something that they would want?
I'm a much bigger fan, I think, of the idea that Google's come up with, which is taking the same idea and applying it to clothing. I think that it makes a little more sense, you know, especially in, you know, when you're walking around outside or something like that, to have a spot where you do this. You know, the big thing that Google's been pushing with this is someone riding their bike. You know, they're riding your bike through a busy city, you know, having the ability to just kind of quickly make adjustments to what you're hearing on your phone or, you know, when you answer a phone call is a whole lot more safe than having to, you know, reach down and grab your phone and push buttons and remember, you know, things like your security code and things like that. Whereas this takes it a little more stylized, but maybe a little less functional over time. It's hard to tell.
Can these tattoos store information too?
Currently, they're designed really more for interaction. There are ways to take this design and incorporate it with storage modules, but that is going to end up taking a little more space. And so it would end up being something like a bracelet, maybe.
That would make sense, I suppose. You talked about it working with a smartphone. What else would it work with? iPods? I mean, is there a specific, or is it mostly just to use with a phone?
Really, the idea here is to just create a control surface for any kind of computer where you would draw a gesture on this thing and it would transfer to whatever it was you were wirelessly connected to. So the obvious translation there is a smartphone or a tablet, something that you would have nearby you at any time. But really, it could be designed for any kind of computer that you would connect to.
Hmm. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, and our guest is Russell Holley from AndroidCentral.com. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Well, another gadget we want to discuss today is a wearable microphone called Capture. That's Capture with a K. What is this product? What does it look like?
We are all about weird gadgets today that we're talking about.
Weird or creepy. They're both a little bit creepy.
That's right. Yeah, just kind of a little unusual. Capture is a unique attempt at making life logging a little more socially acceptable. And if you're unfamiliar with the term, life logging has come from the idea that you have this accessory on you at all times that's taking pictures or recording video every couple of seconds. Without you doing anything. And the idea is that you come to it later on and it gives you something that you can kind of, interact with later so that you can see, you know, this was a thing that I did. This was a place that I went. And it's a cool idea, but it ends up being a little on the creepy side when you think about, you know, the people that you walk into on a daily basis, you're kind of taking their picture without their permission.
Mm-hmm.
So Capture is an audio version of this. It's a microphone that you basically wear on your wrist like a watch or a Fitbit or something like that. And it is constantly recording, but only saving the last 60 seconds of what it is that you're doing. And if you run into something where it's really important information that you want to store, then you double tap on that accessory on your wrist, and it will save that last 60 seconds to your phone so that you can access it later on. So if you've heard something important maybe during a meeting or something like that, you know, instead of scrambling to write it down, you can tap your wrist, and the last 60 seconds of that conversation or that meeting will be saved to your phone that you can access later.
Then you could wear the other one to take pictures and sound all at the same time. So you would.
I don't think that's the goal.
Following your life all day long.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's the life logging concept is kind of interesting when you think about being able to look back at things and be like, oh, I remember when that thing happened. But it's also very intrusive to the world around you, and you have to kind of be aware of that. And Capture, I find, is a little more direct. You know, instead of, looking back and being like, this is everything that you have heard over the last, 24 hours, you have to be very specific about what it is that you're recording and what it is that you're saving. And that, I think, is of greater value because it gives the user a little more control. It gives them the ability to not be intrusive. And I think that when it comes to, privacy out in the world, personal responsibility plays a massive part of that. And so Capture kind of enables that personal responsibility. So I'm more likely to appreciate something like Capture than I am something like a camera that you clip on your chest and just have it take pictures because.
Well, are there legal concerns with either of these products, really?
Well, there are states where, recording audio is a two-party approval system. I live in a state where, both parties have to agree to be recorded in order for that recording to be considered legal. And there are many states in the United States that are like that, but not all of them. And so, you would certainly need to be aware of the laws in where you are in order to do that. But it's also, I think that really only applies if your intent is malicious. If you're recording, something that you're going to keep for yourself and never publish to the world, for notes or for something like that, then I think that there's a bit of innocence there maybe. That could just be me being optimistic. but it's it has the potential to be interesting in very specific situations. I don't know that it's something I would intentionally wear all day every day.
Right. I was going to say, who do you think this is aimed for? Who would find it useful?
I think that the group that I would most attribute this to would be college students. Instead of recording entire lectures and kind of scrabbling through them later to try and dig out the necessary bits of information to, be able to tap their wrist when something really important happens that they want to record the last 60 seconds of. I think that there would be value there. And the same for, professional environments where that kind of audio recording would be useful. I don't know that I would ever put it on when I was going to the grocery store or taking my kids out to play at the park or something like that. But in kind of professional or educational environments, I could see it being valuable.
I think it's interesting that when we talk to you, Russell, it's not just about the new techs, but also tech terms. So I never heard of life logging. So I'm chalking that one up today as something I learned. Life logging.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you either really know about and have very strong opinions of, or you've never heard of before.
What about journals? Remember those?
I do, yeah.
That was life logging. Next up, a phone case for the budding cinematographer. So what about this thing called, and I think I'm pronouncing it right, a la clip studio case?
Yeah, the a la clip studio case, we use our phones to record everything right now, taking pictures of ourselves and taking pictures of others. And, there is just a massive group of people who get very, very interested in using their phone to take the best possible image. Anytime I live near the ocean. And so anytime I go out, to catch a sunrise or something like that, there's always someone nearby to take a picture of that sunrise. And more often than not, especially over the last couple of years, I've seen people, break out their phone in order to take those pictures instead of using a very high-end camera, because our cameras have just gotten very good at taking those kind of pictures. But when it comes to, let's say you're going to a wedding or something where you're going to need to take much higher quality photos because there are limitations when it comes to light or sound or something like that, your phone is still pretty limited for those situations. And a la clip tries to fix that with the most complicated phone case I think that exists for any iPhone. It's really an extremely complicated clip case that allows you to either connect your phone to a tripod or add a microphone attachment to the top or even an LED light grid in order to create more light for the thing that you're recording. And if you strap all of these things together on this phone, you get an iPhone that really just kind of looks like this mutant recording thing that has all of these accessories baked onto it. There are lens attachments in order to provide, better field of view when you're recording, or even a fisheye view if you want to capture, kind of more information. The small boom microphone that you can use to capture better audio when you're talking to someone, and this kind of light mount that will connect to your phone and allow you to record with better lighting than you would get from, say, the flash on your camera. And it's just all of this stuff that comes together and could be very useful to people who know exactly what it is that they're doing. But it also just looks very kind of intimidating if you've never done anything like this before.
Is this just with pictures or does it work with video too?
No, it's definitely designed to work with photos and video.
And could you just use some of the pieces and parts and not all of them? The stuff that would really be useful to most people.
Absolutely. The core behind this, the name Aloclip, it's the case So it's almost like a rail system where you can kind of clip on the things that you need, and they kind of fasten into place around the edge of your phone, thanks to the way that the case that you put your phone in is designed.
Yeah, I wondered how that really worked in different ways that you can attach all these on a phone. And it's the iPhone only?
This is right now, it's kind of limited to the iPhone, and it has to be because, you know, the clip part, the case is the most important thing to make sure that everything kind of clips onto this phone the way that it's supposed to. And so you have to kind of build for a single design first and kind of move out from there, you know, because there are so many different designs to other smartphones, whereas the iPhone is kind of usually always roughly the same size. So it's built initially for the iPhone 6 and 7.
And what is the quality of this, either camera-based or video-based?
It's entirely what you make of it. You know, if you are familiar enough with using lighting to enhance, you know, video that you are recording, then this can be a tremendous asset, you know, to kind of increase the lighting that you would need. On the other hand, if you are in a movie theater and you are trying to take a selfie with a giant LED clip on the back, then you're going to find the results are going to be very poor. And the same goes for audio. You know, people who are familiar with using this kind of thing to enhance their photos and videos can get extraordinary results that the iPhone alone is just not capable of. And the same goes for any smartphone. You know, these are, you know, kind of professional, very nearly professional grade tools to enhance photos and videos.
So in the longer, larger trend, are we just going to see more people using their smartphones for cameras? Are cameras obsolete?
I think that there is definitely an increasing dividing line between people who are perfectly comfortable using their phone to capture all of their family events and life events versus people who are willing to spend the extra, you know, between $500 to $1,000 for a separate camera that they would use for those experiences.
Okay, well, another product you recently reviewed was called, is this Tribi? Tribi?
Yes, the Tribi.
Tribi.
I found this to be absolutely fascinating for parents. If you are familiar with the Amazon Echo, Amazon has built this kind of pillar speaker that listens to you and kind of acts like Siri, but for your house.
Oh, okay.
And not just for you personally. And the Amazon Echo has been this you know, very popular thing for people who are willing to spend that kind of $200 to have this Siri for your home almost. And it has a lot of really incredible features, but it's also limited to very specific situations and placing it in your house in very specific places because of the way that it's designed. And so to help with that, Amazon released their what they call the Alexa service as a set of software tools that can be added to any kind of you know, speaker system with a computer and a microphone inside. And so their first official partner for this kind of expansion was this Tribi speaker. And it's designed for the kitchen instead of for the living room or a bedroom or something like that. And it's this magnetic rectangle, basically, that you know, adheres to, you know, anything metal. But really, the refrigerator is the most common place that you're going to see it. And it adds, you know, a big speaker that is connected to, you know, all of your music streaming services and radio stations and the Amazon Alexa service, so that you have that speaker right there in your kitchen to do things like ask for quick measurement conversions when you're cooking, or just, you know, listen to music or podcasts, or even, you know, keep a to-do list for things like shopping as people are coming in. And it's simple enough that anyone in the house can use it. Everyone in my house uses it from, you know, age 6 up.
Well, could there be any dangers with kids using it? Is there anything that they could get into trouble by using something like this?
The only danger there is, from my experience after having set it up and had them use it for a while, is my 6-year-old son absolutely loves adding silly things to my grocery list. So I went and last week went grocery shopping and pulled up the Amazon list on my phone, and there were 19 entries for toilet paper. and so that's the biggest concern there.
Well, I might see 19 entries for Oreos, but, you know, toilet paper. Hey, thanks a lot, Russell. It's good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have, Russell Holly. Thank you again, and thanks for listening. I'm Gail Hogan. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.